The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
I just got to give you a brief heads up. First of all, it's good to have you guys back here. I haven't seen you in a while. Just in terms of what we're going to do this morning, you guys are headed to Poland. So we're going to use this opportunity to kind of discuss some of those issues, and I'll give you a perspective. I went to Poland for the first time last year, and it was definitely a mind-boggling experience. For me, it was too short, and I hope to go back. I think it's important that we go back regularly, and that's a whole discussion that's a waste of your time until you've been there. But just to give you an idea, we were, there's some things that you'll see there that are so huge that you can't comprehend them. I don't even know if you can try to comprehend them. And, you know, what I thought we would do this morning is I have a topic to share with you. And then we're going to kind of open up the floor a little to some Q&A. And then we're going to go out and take a walk, wake you up a little, including something which, if it's open, will be a very significant piece of your preparation for this trip. Libriot, right? Anyway, we got off the plane and we went pretty much straight to Majdanek. And places like Majdanek and Auschwitz for me were just overwhelming. It's just too big to comprehend. And at the end of that first day, so we were driving back and we were passing Lublin. And I wasn't like you guys. I wasn't in a big group with a tour and part of a program. We were about four or five guys in a car, and I went to help somebody out. And so we decided to stop in at Lublin. I said, we can't pass by Lublin and not stop at Lublin. They're like, well, it's 9 o'clock at night. Nobody's going to be there. I said, no, we have to go to Lublin because the Yeshivat Chachmei Lublin, which I imagine you're probably going to go to. I don't know. Meir Shapiro, who started, by the way, the whole Daf Yomi, daily page of the Daf. Until a couple of years ago, this yeshiva was actually a medical school. And they were using the Beis Medrash to store cadavers. It was unbelievable. And the Jewish community in the world rallied, and they actually got the building back. But it's still pretty much empty. It was like a... And so we get there, and we're banging on the door trying to get in, and we hear, like, noise. And somebody comes to the door, and there's, like, this caretaker who sees that we're Jewish, and I guess he's used to Jews coming by, and so he lets us in. We walk into this Beis Medrash, and you know, if you've learned Torah from Meir Shapira, and I studied Daf Yomi, and you know, at a certain point, it just hits you that you're sitting in the yeshiva that was opened 100 years ago, and I'm sitting there, and you know, I hadn't davened Maariv, I hadn't prayed that evening. And I was with guys who were really basically secular guys. So I told them, you know, I'm just going to take 10 minutes and go off on the side and do my thing. And I was in the middle of Hanukkah. And I really struggled with whether to go, because to be away from my family enough to be in Poland on Hanukkah. I mean, that country is basically a Jewish cemetery. I can't think of a more depressing place to be on Hanukkah, right? And this is like the third night of Hanukkah, and we just landed in Warsaw that morning or whatever. And I'm like overwhelmed. And as I'm davening Maariv, I hear this sound from the distance. And it sounds like they're singing Hanukkah songs. And I'm thinking, okay, this is a little weird, you know? And I'm looking at the other guys. Nobody else is noticing anything. So I think maybe I'm hallucinating. I don't want to say anything because they'll think I'm whacked. But every now and then I just hear this, like, distant sound. So I'm thinking maybe I'm really into my davening and it's just bringing down some energy. I don't know what's going on. Anyway, so I finished davening. And I can hear, like, in the distance again. Like, I heard 10 minutes earlier. I hear, like, like, woohoo! It's a little weird. There are no Jews in Lublin. There's like a few hundred Jews left in Lublin. They're all like 90 years old, right? So I'm about to go over to the guys, you know, and I want to tell them a little about where they're standing. And did you know that this was the place where Meir Shapira? And this guy walks into the entrance of the Beis Medrash with a long black coat and a white beard and a strimal. I swear I almost passed out. I was like, whoa! So I didn't want to say anything to him. I said, Dan, do you see that guy or am I hallucinating? He turns and goes, whoa. So it turns out that it's this Chabad rabbi who's from Lublin, and he's there. And I'm thinking, this is amazing. We just ran into like the Chabad rabbi of Lublin. So we start talking to him. He says, why don't you join us? We're having a Hanukkah party downstairs. So I'm like, well, okay, now I know I'm not nuts, because that's why I was hearing Hanukkah songs. So we go downstairs. There's about 40 or 50 people there. The average age was about 85, right? And, you know, you got to give credit to Chabad, only Chabad. They're just everywhere. You know, go to Nepal, be in the middle of nowhere, take out two candles, scream out, I need matches to light Shabbos candles, some Chabad rabbi will pop up behind the rock. They're unbelievable. And Chabad is in Lublin, and they've actually just opened up in Krakow, from what I hear, and they were doing this Hanukkah party. And most people in the world, like, they would never start an organization to run a program for 80-year-olds, you know? But if you think about it, they're all Holocaust survivors. And, you know, what an unbelievable thing that, these Jews who've been so distant from Judaism. So I go downstairs, and of course, you know, like, you've just lowered the median age by, you know, 100%. So they're all excited that there are people there. So one of them asked me to speak. So I don't know what to do because I don't speak any Polish. You know, there are a couple of people, we start going around the room, so a couple of them speak Russian, and one of them speaks French. I'm like, no. So we finally find someone who knows enough English, and I'm telling the story, and they're translating, and then I sit down at this table. And I meet this woman named Mara. And Mara is she's like the youngster of the group. She's like 70, 75. And it turns out that she was a partisan. She fought in the partisans with Polish partisans, but she could never tell them that she was Jewish. Because she knew with absolute certainty that if she would ever tell them she was Jewish, they would kill her. So here she is fighting the Nazis, but she can't tell them that she's Jewish because then they'll join the Nazis, right? And she falls in love with one of the heads of the partisan group. And they end up becoming sweethearts, and they get married. And she never tells him that she's Jewish. And as it, you know, sort of the war finally ends, and now they're married a couple of years, she can't bring herself to tell this guy that she's Jewish, because then she's basically, you know, I've been lying to you for 2 years, we're married. So she decides, what's the point? She doesn't feel very Jewish anyway, and she pretty much dumped everything Jewish to begin with. And whatever was left of her Jewish spark, she thought was long gone, because why would God let that happen anyway? So she lives a life as a Polish citizen, was a partisan, and she actually received a medal for her role in the partisans. And, you know, eventually when the communists took over, so the partisans were heroes. And about a year earlier, her husband passed away. And she finally decided that she wanted to find out what it means to be a Jew. Can you imagine? 75-year-old woman decides she has to find out what it means to be Jewish. And you guys get to do this, you're 18 years old. She can do this till she was 75 years old. And I walked away from this evening, and just so many thoughts run through your heads and so many questions. There's the big questions, and there's the little questions. And the little questions, well, so what do you do with a story like that? What do you do with a journey like that? Is that a good story? So on one hand, you have this person who survived the war, and despite everything the Nazis did, you know, I mean, I was wondering how we're going to light Hanukkah candles. And then all of a sudden, you're lighting Hanukkah candles in Lublin, in Rav Meir Shapira's Beis Medrash, with like, you know, 60 Holocaust survivors. You can't have a more meaningful Hanukkah. So on the one hand, that's an amazing story. On the other hand, yeah, but you know, there were 1.5 million Jews. There were 3 million Jews in Poland. And they're all gone. So how do you deal with that? What's the point? What's the object of everything we're doing? What do you do with the Holocaust in general? Right? So, I just want to be clear about something. This is probably one of the most critical questions that we can deal with. And if you think you're going to get the answer to the question, you are definitely sitting in the wrong place. I'm not sure we're meant to answer this question. But at the same time, not to struggle with this question is absurd. So, really the purpose, not just of this morning, but of your trip, is to struggle with this question and to put it in its place. And that's why really I thought it was appropriate that, you know, at the end of this discussion that we can open up the floor to questions. If you see you really want to get out and walk, we can do the questions and answers on the road. That's number one. Number two, I just want you to be aware. This discussion, you could call it From Darkness into Light. It's based on the 28th chapter of Dvarim, Perek Chafchet. This is not an objective discussion. This is very much an opinion. I'm going to share with you something that I have to be honest, I'm not even sure is correct, right? And I would have no issue with anyone who thinks that this is nonsense. And I would have no issue with anyone who looks at what I'm about to share with you and say, you know, I don't see it that way, right? And it could be that the only thing that you'll get out of this is to see someone's perspective on something that you might view differently. And if it causes you to do a little reading and a little searching on your own, that would be worthwhile. So that's the first thing I want you to be aware of. The second thing I want you to be aware of is, you know, you've gotten to know me a little bit. So you may have noticed that, you know, when we do a class, I like to start with a story, and, you know, the story takes us someplace, and then we get into the meat. This particular discussion, if you're waiting for the meat, you're going to keep waiting. The only way I know to share this topic of discussion is through stories. I just don't know any other way to do it, right? So, you know, I think that when you learn long enough, you know, you develop your own relationship with the things that you learn, right? You guys now have been learning for the better part of a year, and I imagine that there are certain texts that you really enjoy and certain things you don't. Certain things, certain classes you look forward to, and certain classes by statistical reality that you could do without, and that's the way life goes. And I think that's true sort of as you go on in your life. There are certain things I love to learn, and certain things that never hit me. And I think when you study Tanakh, so there's certain prakim, there's certain pieces that you really relate to. If I could pick the parak in Tanakh, really two prakim, that had the most impact on me in my life, this would be it. This had such an impact on me, and I want to share with you why, but again, I'm giving you the caveat, this is just me. This is just how I relate to this parak, and I really could be totally off. And that's okay, right? This is the 28th chapter in Dvarim. It's probably one of the most difficult prakim in all of Tanakh. Okay? It starts out great. And if, by the way, anybody here wants to follow along in the Tanakh, there are Tanakhim over there. You know, if you want to just listen, that's okay. If 2 minutes in you say, wait a second, I want to look that up, feel free to get up, walk over to that shelf and pick up a Tanakh. You know, whatever you want. Okay? Right? In fact, you know what, if you're going over, maybe grab a few. Yeah, thanks. So it starts out great. Okay? If you look in Perek Chavchet, it says like this. V'ayah im tishamo atishma b'kol Hashem alokecha. If you will listen to everything Hashem says, right? Asher anochi mitzavcha ayom. U'netancha Hashem alokecha ayom. And then God will make you supreme. Uvau alecha kol ha-brachot ha'ila. All of these blessings will come to pass. 14 psukim, 14 verses. Of all the brachot, everything good that will happen to the Jewish people, right? And by the way, this is interesting. Because if you accept the beginning of this perek at face value, then what it means is that when things are good, we must be doing something right. But when things are not good, maybe we're doing something wrong. And that's an interesting discussion to get to when we finish this discussion, right? Alright. And then, and you can read through the brachot, all the things that would go right if we were just getting our act together. And then you get to Pasuk Tetvav. Okay? The 15th Pasuk. Pasuk Tetvav, V'aya, and it will come to pass. Im lo tishma b'kol Hashem alokecha, lishmo lasot et kol mitzvot v'chukotav. If you will not listen to all of those things that Hashem asks of us to do, if we don't get it, Uvau alecha kol haklalot ha'ila v'hisigucha. Then all of these klalot, all these curses, they will come upon you and they will find you. They will catch you up. Reminds me of the story of the St. Louis. Ever hear of the boat, the St. Louis? St. Louis was probably one of those little stories that's one of the most tragic episodes of the Holocaust because of what might have been, right? The St. Louis was the last boat to leave Nazi-occupied Germany. Okay? In 1939, there were 950 passengers on board this boat, and they had paid $500 U.S. equivalent, this is in 1939, for safe passage, and another $250 for a visa to enter Cuba. Now, you have to understand what $750 is in 1939. First of all, realize these Jews, who were almost all from Germany and Austria, they had nothing. When Hitler came to power in 1933, he very quickly passed the Nuremberg Laws, which basically made it forbidden for Jews to practice anything, medicine, law, business, anything. Their shops were banned or destroyed. They were then forced to go into the ghetto. Now, when you went to the ghetto, what did you do with your home and your property? You were about to move from maybe the large five-bedroom apartment you lived in, and now you had to squeeze in with three other families into a one-room apartment. So you had to sell your stuff, and you had no money because you couldn't work. And most of the non-Jews in Berlin, in Vienna, in Austria, in Germany, right, they knew that you had to sell. If you were caught in Berlin proper, as an example, in Germany proper, after a specific date that you were supposed to be in the ghetto, so you were hauled off to Dachau, right? If you had no place to be and you weren't in the ghetto, you were an indigent. You were hauled off to Dachau, beaten or worse. So you had to get into the ghetto. But you knew you wouldn't be able to work, so what's the natural thing to do? You want to sell your house. Yeah, but who's going to buy a house from a Jew? So a $100,000 home sells for $1,800. I mean, the prices that Jews were given by their non-Jewish compatriots were absurd. You know, imagine that you're living in an area and, you know, 5,000 homes come on the market in one neighborhood, right? So they had no money. They were forced into the ghetto. Very soon they were starving, right? Comes along Kristallnacht in 1938. 30,000 Jews are put into Dachau, most of them from Germany and Austria. And the Jews realize it's time to get out. The Germans know that the Jews have realized it's time to get out. The shipping lines that went through Bremen, which were still allowed to take Jews out of Germany, because at that time, all Hitler wanted was to get the Jews out, right? They can charge whatever they want. Jews have no money, they have no job. Most of their ability to raise this money came from like relatives in America or overseas. $500. I was curious once what $500 was in the equivalent of today's term. In other words, if you translate the economy, the statistics, the ratio per capita, work, etc., what is $500 today? $500 today is about $10,000. So you have no job, you have no place to live, you don't know what you're doing, you're desperate to get out, you've got six people in your family, and you have to come up, basically, with almost $100,000. That's unbelievable. 950, really 960 Jews succeed in getting on this boat. They set sail, and they dock off the port of Cuba, where Cuba is undergoing food riots because the economy in Cuba is so bad. And they're debating whether they should be letting in refugees because they're afraid it might topple the government. So a special government committee debates this topic for a couple of days. By the time they decide they're going to let them in, people have found out about it. There are riots at the docks. They decide they can't let them in because if they let refugees in, it might topple the government. They finally decide they'll let them in if each person pays an additional $250. You understand? $250. I mean, that's like a fortune of money. $250,000 then is how much money now? In 3 days, three organizations, including HIAS, the International Aid Society, Hebrew International Aid Society, actually succeed in raising this money. And they send the guarantees to Cuba, but by that time it's too late, and Cuba won't let them in. And there begins one of the saddest stories in Jewish history, maybe, as this boat begins to sail around the world, trying to find safe haven. They even dock off the coast of America, down by Miami, while a special congressional subcommittee debates for 3 days the topic of whether, since the quota has been met, they should allow 960 Jewish refugees into America in 1939. No one lets them in. They even go back to France. No one lets them in. And eventually they're forced back to Germany. Some of the children succeed in being sent to Britain. The rest of them all end up in Auschwitz and disappear. There are almost no survivors from that boat. Uvau alecha klalot ha'ile v'hisigucha. And these curses, you may run from them, but they'll find you. They'll catch you up. Now, when I read this perek, to me, and again, this is a dangerous topic, this is just to me, this perek in Tanakh speaks to me of the Holocaust. I just see the Holocaust hidden in between its lines. You know? Arurata ba'ir, you'll be cursed in the city. Ve'arurata b'sadeh, in Pasuk Yutet, arurata b'voecha, ve'arurata b'tzeitecha, you'll be cursed in your coming, you'll be cursed in your going. You know, the Mefarshim, some of the commentaries say, what does it mean that you're cursed in your coming and you're cursed in your going? It means that you have no purpose. You don't know whether you're coming or going. There was a great Rav, who I think we once spoke about. His name was Rav Ephraim Ashri. He was one of the last rabbis of the Kovno ghetto. And he's an amazing story in and of himself, which I think I once told you about, so stop me if this sounds familiar. But when the Nazis got to Kovno, Lithuania, so they still hadn't unveiled, you know, their true face. They were still pretending that they were sending people to work camps. And what they would do is they would start by creating these work gangs and sending Jews out to do all sorts of ridiculous work projects, right? Work will set you free. Now, he was old enough, you know, late 50s, 60s, with a long white beard, that they couldn't get away with putting him in a work gang. But the thought that a rabbi, a rabbiner, would be walking around with nothing to do, that drove them nuts. So they found him a job, and they got him this ridiculous Keystone Cop outfit, and they made him a watchman. And they loved to walk by and laugh at this rabbi, right? Because now he was guarding a warehouse. And he didn't know exactly what he was guarding, and the idea that he was guarding it was ridiculous, but that was his job. Eventually he got curious, what were all these high-ranking Nazi officials doing walking in and out of his warehouse? So he snuck a peek. And he discovered that he was guarding a storehouse, a treasury, for the looted wealth of the Jewish people that was being kept for a museum that they were going to create in Berlin after the war of the extinct Jewish race. There's actually a display about this in Yad Vashem, right? They were gonna make this big museum, the extinct Jewish race. Now, what was most of what the Nazis were collecting that they were willing to store and not steal? Tzarim. You know, the paintings were disappearing and the gold and silver was disappearing, but they had nothing to do for the Tzarim. So they were, and because the Nazis were so meticulous, they actually had a whole libriot. They had a whole catalog system. They were cataloging these books. We have the catalog of the Tzarim that were in that warehouse, even though most of them were burnt. In fact, I managed to once see this two copies of Rav Tzadok HaKohen, one of Rav Tzadok HaKohen of Lublin Svarim, that we don't have to this day. All the copies have been burned. We're in that warehouse. I sometimes think if only, like, you know, Rav Shuri had grabbed one. Anyway, so basically what they'd done is they'd given this tremendous Talmud Chacham a library. So word got around that Rav Shuri had access to Svarim. People started asking him their questions. And he answered them as best he could. He kept a record of what the questions were and how he had answered them, because he obviously couldn't answer them the way he would have before the war. And he wrote them down on little pieces of scripts of paper, and he stuffed them into little cans, and he buried them. He survived the war. He got back to Kovno, to the ghetto, and he dug them up. And he published them in 1947 as a comprehensive work of response called Mima Makim, From the Depths. It's an amazing, amazing set. It's very simple Hebrew, five volumes, and there's a one-volume annotated edition, like edited in English, which is just unbelievable reading, and it's a great thing to read. And Tisha B'Av, basically a summary of some of the questions and some of his answers without all the halachic back and forth in which he describes how he'd answered. In the beginning of each of these questions, he tells the story of how the question came to him. I mean, the questions are unbelievable questions. You know, can you make a Seder on four cups of water? What blessing do you make if you're being forced to eat pig on Yom Kippur? Right? If a woman knows that if the Nazis catch her pregnant, they'll perform an on-site abortion with a pistol, is she allowed to do an abortion herself? I mean, just to be on the level to ask these questions, to care what Allah has to say, is amazing. So he tells one story, which was actually from the Black Day of the Kovno Ghetto. Forget the date, but I think it was in 1941. The Nazis gathered together all the Jews of the Kovno Ghetto that were left, about 80,000 of them, stuck them into the Umstadtplatz, the general platform. It was a terrible, terrible day, the rain and hail, and they all knew that they were going to die. It was very clear that they were being taken off to the Ninth Fortress. And some Jew hops over to Rav Shri and manages to ask him a question. He wants to know what the nusach, what the version of the blessing is, if you think you're going to die al Kiddush Hashem. It's a mitzvah to die al Kiddush Hashem. Right? If you're going to die, at least, you know. And if you're dying al Kiddush Hashem, do you make a blessing? And if you make a bracha, what's the bracha? And he's amazed that this Jew is asking this question. And the Jew describes his story of how he got to Kovno. He had actually come from Warsaw. And he had thought it would be safer in Kovno. And he describes how on the road, you know, tens of thousands of refugees were leaving Warsaw, headed for Lithuania and for Kovno. And they were passing tens of thousands of refugees on the road who thought that it was safer to go to Warsaw. I don't know whether you're coming or going. You know? Yishalach Hashem b'cha tameira, etamuma v'tamigeret. There's a whole list here of diseases, sicknesses. The Malbim says, if I'm not mistaken, that all of these diseases are diseases that are caused by starvation and overcrowding. Right? Pestilence. B'chol mishlach yadcha asher taseh ad hishamdecha v'ad avdecha maher, until you are completely destroyed, quickly. It's interesting that, the Pasuk says in Pasuk Chavalef, yadbeik Hashem b'chat adaver ad kaloto otcha me'al ha'adama asher ata ba sham al rishta, until you are completely wiped out from the land that you come to inherit. It's interesting. Normally the land that you come to inherit is what? What's the Eretz Asher Ata Ba Sham L'Rishta? No? Eretz Israel. This is one of the only cases in Tanakh where there are some Mefarshim who suggest that this actually isn't talking about Eretz Israel. It's very interesting. In other words, the Meshech Chachma talks about this. If you think that that land is the land that you will inherit, I will show you that that is not your land to inherit. Now, notwithstanding the tremendously difficult questions that this raises, that's a whole different way to look at this pasuk. It's interesting that it says, ad kaloto, until you're destroyed. In the history of the Jewish people, there has never been an instance where the Jewish people were entirely wiped out. Even after the Churban Bayit, when the Beit HaMikdash was destroyed, second Beit HaMikdash, there was still a large Jewish population that remained, or they were exiled after Bayit Rishon. You know, I don't know, the Spanish Inquisition, Khmelnytsky's massacres. The only time where really the entire Jewish population of an entire era, an entire country was wiped out, was the Holocaust. Yekachashim b'shachefet uv'kadachat uv'dalekit, with inflammations and fevers, uv'harhu, extreme burning, uv'cherev, uv'shitafon, uv'yerakon, with mold and mildew. V'ayu shamecha asher al roshcha nechoshet, v'aretz asher tartecha barzel. You know, it's interesting. When I was finishing high school, there was a case that was brought before the Anti-Defamation League. An interesting case. Seems that a number of large conglomerates in Germany were buying up large tracts of land, amongst them Poland. Turned out that what they were buying the land for was mineral deposits. Right? Up until that time, a lot of the minerals that Europe, especially Western Europe, imported came from, like, you know, Siberia and areas in Kazakhstan. And that obviously was very difficult for all sorts of reasons, especially in the Cold War. They had found large mineral deposits in certain areas in Poland. Now, it turned out that all of these areas were the sites of mass killings, including, by the way, the area of Treblinka. They wanted to buy the area of Treblinka and turn it into mines, to mine minerals. Something to do with, you know, the bodies that were there and how it affects the earth and causes the minerals to rise. I don't really understand it. So the Anti-Defamation League, I think Rabbi Weiss got very involved in this. They fought this, they won, they stopped the deal. Right? When you go to the death camps and you walk into the gas chambers, you'll see a very interesting detail if you look for it. In the corners of the gas chambers, you'll see that it's all green. They're green spots. And that's because what they used was Zyklon B. Zyklon B's key ingredient is copper dioxide. So what it does is it turns certain areas to green from the copper. There's a pasuk here, Vayu Shamecha Shel Rosh Chanechoshet, which many Mefarshim, although Rashi has his interpretation, actually have difficulty with. It's not really clear what this pasuk means. The sky above you will turn to copper. Ve'aretz asher tachtecha barzel, and the land beneath you will become iron. Yitein Hashem et metar artzecha avak, ve'afar min hashamayim yered alecha adi shamdach. Dust and ground will rain down upon you from the heavens until you are destroyed. You can imagine what that might be. Yiteincha Hashem nigaf lifnei oivecha. You will become like a plague before your enemy. Vayita l'zava l'chol mamlachot ha'aretz. And you will become an abhorrence, a disgusting thing, before all the kingdoms of the earth. You know, it's interesting. There was a famous conference, if I'm not mistaken, at Evian in 1940. And the topic of the conference, which, by the way, all the Western countries attended, Canada, Australia, America, right, Roosevelt. The topic of the conference was the refugee problem in the world. Now, everybody knew that in 1940, that was a euphemism for the Jewish problem. Everybody knew it. They wanted to try to figure out what to do. In 1940, okay, Hitler was not interested in destroying the Jewish people. I don't know if you've been studying, preparing for the Holocaust, but this is very easy to read. He just wanted Germany and Europe to be Judenrein. He wanted them out. He was quite happy to get rid of them and send them anywhere. So there was a conference, what to do with the Jewish refugees. And one by one, the countries explained that they could not change their quotas, and they would not let any Jews into the country. In fact, the most amazing response, which is on file and on display in Yad Vashem, was, if I'm not mistaken, Australia's. Australia said, the reason that they don't want to allow Jews into the country is because there's no anti-Semitism in Australia. And anti-Semitism is a horrible thing. And if we let Jews into the country, there'll be anti-Semitism. So in order to prevent the spread of anti-Semitism, we're better off not letting refugees in. Can you imagine? Can you imagine? In 1944, in the summer of 1944, okay, there was a fellow, if I'm not mistaken, his name was Joel Roth. Joel Roth wanted to broker a deal between the Nazis and the Allies. The last major population center of Jews to fall to the Nazis was Hungary in 1944. Up until then, Hungary had been a German ally, and therefore, for whatever the reason, the Jews were protected. That means they were only in ghettos and beaten from time to time, but they weren't sent to the concentration camps. In the summer, really the spring of 1944, everything hit the fan, and they started deporting Jews to Auschwitz. They murdered over 400,000 Jews in less than 5 months. Hitler at the time was desperate for trucks, because the reason he was losing the war on the Eastern Front was because of his supply lines, which is amazing when you stop to think about the fact that he was using all of his rail lines to transport Jews to Auschwitz, but that's another discussion. So Joel Roth, I'll spare you the details, there's a whole book written about this topic you can look up and find. Joel Roth succeeded in getting in touch with no less than Adolf Eichmann. And Adolf Eichmann agreed to a deal. He was willing to trade the Jews of Hungary for 400 trucks. To demonstrate that he was capable of fulfilling his end of the deal, they stopped the killings in Auschwitz for 2 weeks in August of 1944. For 2 weeks in August of 1944, the oven stopped, the crematoria stopped, the transport stopped, and Jews were not mass murdered in Auschwitz. The Allies refused. Not only did they refuse, but when Joel Roth, the whole story how he managed to get into British territory with a Lysander plane in the middle of the night, because Germany couldn't be seen to be letting him go. When he landed, he was arrested by the British. He was thrown into a prison cell. He was kept there until the end of the war, and I believe in 1947 he committed suicide. Do you understand what this means? 400,000 Jews were not worth 400 trucks. Okay? 1,000 Jews were not worth a truck. So what was one Jew not worth? Half a tire? Steering wheel. There'll be no one. There'll be no one to listen and no one to care. No man will scare away the birds that come to pick at your bodies. And one of the mafreshim says, because there'll be too many bodies. You know, I'm reminded of a picture. There's a movie called Night and Fog. I don't know if you've ever seen this. Very, very powerful film. I think it's Night and Fog. There's a piece in there among the crematoria of the Warsaw Ghetto. And you can see, there's a famous picture, you can see this people sort of walking on the street in the Warsaw Ghetto. And there's one couple, she obviously is protected or something because she has like a hose on and a fur coat. And she's walking with a capo, a Jewish policeman. And they're walking through the streets and he's sort of turned to her half and he's laughing. And lying on the street all around them are bodies. People subsisted in the Warsaw Ghetto on a diet of less than 130 calories a day. That's about a third of a Hershey candy bar. Imagine if you had a third of a Hershey candy bar to live on every day and that was it. So people just dropped dead in the streets. And at the beginning they had wheelbarrow brigades. They would get kids to load bodies onto wheelbarrows and they would shovel them into mass graves in the cemetery. But eventually they couldn't even do that. There were just too many bodies. So they would collect them and burn them. That's where we'll reach. Yakecha Hashem b'shchin Mitzrayim u'v'afelim u'v'garev u'v'cheres asher lo tuchal leherapei. You will be subjected to diseases, to ailments, to pain that will not be healed. You know? I remember, you know, we have this image, and I include myself in this group. When did World War II end? When did the Holocaust end? Anybody? 1945. That's what most people will tell you. Right? The Holocaust ended in 1945. You are about to discover that that's completely untrue. It's completely untrue for three reasons. Okay? First, I remember I was at a Yom HaShoah ceremony, and I made the cardinal error of getting there on time, which in Israel means you're way early, right? And there was a couple who, their names are the Tiefenbruns, he's actually since passed away. Amazing fellow, he was a Holocaust survivor, and he actually made Aliyah, he gave up waiting for his children to come home, so he made Aliyah at the age of 78. Who makes Aliyah at 78? And he helped to build Efrat. And he passed away a couple years ago at the age of like 93. And so I was sitting there, this was like years ago, and so I'm trying to make conversation, you know, because just the three of us in this room. So I said to him, this must be very difficult for you to come here and to bring up all these memories. He looked at me like I was an idiot. He said, bring up all these memories. I said, I haven't had a night's sleep in 50 years. I haven't had a night without nightmares in 50 years. Can you imagine? This fellow, he told me a story. In 1939, when the Nazis invaded Poland, they lived in a village outside of Warsaw. And they assumed that this would be like all the other times, right? You know, sometimes it was the Russians, sometimes it was the Poles, so now it would be the Germans. So what would they do? They would come, they would want the young men for the army, because there was a war coming. So all the Jewish guys knew that they had to get out of town, because you didn't want to be a Jewish guy going to, you know, the Nazi army. So all the men left town and they ran into the forest, and they figured 3 days later it would all calm down, right? Only this time it didn't happen quite that way, right? And he never saw his wife and children again. In fact, he ended up in Shanghai. And on VE Day, on the day that they announced the victory over Europe, he actually had a horrible story, because in the morning he received a message that they had found his wife alive, and then it turned out it was a mistake. And they had to tell him, after he thought that she had been found alive with one of his children, in fact his entire family, the day that they left town, the next morning, had been taken out into the forest and shot. Lost his wife and three children. Can you imagine? And not just that he lost them, but that they could have come with him, but it didn't even occur to them that there was a reason to do that. Madness. And you meet these people, and they're married, and they have children, and they have grandchildren, but they had a whole family that they lost that was just stripped away from them. That's the first reason the Holocaust didn't end in 1945, because for these survivors, they live with this every day. The second reason it didn't end in 1945 is, imagine, you know, it's interesting, they've actually changed this. I was actually part of a longer story of a whole committee to get the Holocaust Museum to change this, but when they established the Washington Holocaust Museum, the end of the Holocaust Museum, when you went on the tour, have you been to the Holocaust Museum in Washington? So you'll note then that it's probably changed by now, but when they opened it, the last display was a big photo of Victory Over Europe Day, the famous picture of the sailor kind of leaning over, you know, and kissing that nurse. You ever see that picture in Times Square, right? So in Yad Vashem, that's not how the museum ends. The museum ends with a display of the survivors, because the Holocaust didn't end. Imagine, and we once had this discussion, but you may not remember this. Imagine that it's 1933, and you're a law student. And you're a year away from getting your law degree and, you know, starting to earn those big bucks. And then Hitler comes to power. First thing that happens is you're not allowed to be in university. So you get kicked out of university. And no lawyer will take you, and no government licensing fee, you know, will deal with you. So you can't get your law degree, much less take the bar. And then you end up maybe in the ghetto, and then maybe after Kristallnacht you end up in Dachau. And maybe if you're lucky or unlucky, depending on your perspective, from 1938 to 1945, after 7 years, maybe you actually survive. And maybe in 1945, you're in a DP camp, right? The displaced persons camp, which is basically Auschwitz, Majdanek, Buchenwald, Bergen-Belsen, except now they're British and American guards. They had no idea what to do with all these survivors. Hundreds of thousands of Jews. And maybe over 3 years, you know, living in these DP camps, you finally decide enough is enough, and you smuggle yourself onto a boat, part of the illegal immigrant boat, because you don't have relatives in America who will bring you over. And you land in Israel off the coast of Haifa, you know? And the British are hunting you down now because it's illegal for Jews to come into this country in 1948. And you succeed in breaking the British blockade and you join the war effort. And then maybe you end up as a soldier in the Israeli army, first the Palmach and later the army. And then maybe in 1950, when the armistice is signed and the War of Independence is finally over, in a country that has soup lines, you manage to get maybe a small flat somewhere you're sharing with someone. And now you have to decide what to do with your life. Think about it. In 1933, you were, what, 21 years old, about to finish law school. Now, it's 17 years later, right? You're 40. You have no family. You have not a penny to your name. You have no home. You have no degree, no profession, no vocation. Just a whole suitcase full of nightmares. What do you do? What do you do? The Holocaust isn't over by a long shot. In fact, the most amazing thing about this country is that we took hundreds of thousands of these people and we gave them jobs, we gave them homes, and we rehabilitated them, and that this country isn't completely wacko is nothing short of amazing. You know? Lo tuchal le'herapeh. I remember I once met a woman who was one of Mengele's twins. You know Mengele, Josef Mengele, was the doctor of Auschwitz. You will see a picture of him when you go to the platform at Auschwitz-Birkenau, and you walk down those tracks, and if you're privileged enough, as I was, that it's a freezing cold day. Well, we went in December, and it was so cold, and I brought gatkes, and I had this great coat on, and I'm walking down these tracks of Auschwitz, and the cold, it like gets into your bones. And when we got there, and the rain was pouring, at first I thought, oh, this is such a bad move to come here now. I should have come in the spring when it's like easier. And as the trip went on, I was actually glad that I did this, because I don't think I ever would have understood this. It hit me like I'm walking here in my gatkes and a pair of jeans with this magnificent North Point, nothing breaks through this coat, and I'm freezing. And these people, they walked in pajamas. And you walk to the end, they've put a picture on a stand, a sign of Josef Mengele doing his infamous selection. And I don't know what will be going on in your group that day. Make it a point to go over to that sign and to look at his face. And it will give you a world of understanding. You know? How do you ever get healed? Yakecha Hashem b'shigaon, Hashem will strike you with madness. You will become mad from that which you see. Elie Wiesel tells a story in the book Night. By the way, if you want to read one book, to prepare you for going to Poland, if I had to pick a book, I think it would be this one. It's, by the way, a book that's so well written, aside from all the prizes it won, you won't be able to put it down. My advice to you is not to read it on a night when you're on your own in your room. That's just my advice. Okay, a lot of strong-willed people get nightmares in this book. It's a very powerful book. There were a few years where I chose to read it every year and read it every year in Tisha B'Av. It's a good book to read on Tanya Esther, whatever. But or even to just take with you on the plane on the way to Poland. It's a thin book. You can read it in 3 hours. He tells a story in there of a woman. He gets off the train on the platform in Auschwitz-Birkenau. And, you know, he celebrated his bar mitzvah in Auschwitz. And he describes all the stories, you know. When you read this book, you think it's like a whole day affair. Well, everything he's describing there happens in about 10 minutes. Screaming and yelling and shooting and dogs barking. And they put them on the selection. Now, they were trying to hide this because they didn't want the Jews to panic, because that would make life a little more difficult. So they had all these brilliant systems. You can see this really well at my dynamic. You know, they had like luggage tags. They gave them luggage tags and they told them to put them on their luggage. They had to write their birthday on their luggage, because that was the easiest way to find it afterwards, right? They would order it according to the birthdays, and then you knew that your child's birthday was, you know, May of 1940, so you went to the May 1940 bubble, you could find your child's suitcase. Brilliant, right? And they knew that the Germans were fanatics for systems, and why would they bother with such a system if they weren't going to come back to get their luggage? Brilliant. So they got luggage tags, and they put their names, and you can see a room with just a sampling of hundreds of suitcases that are sitting behind glass, and you look at these scribbled in chalk dates that are on the suitcases, and it like hits you. You know, where people were at, and why people were writing on these suitcases, and what it meant to them, and how much they yearned to just get their suitcases back, because that would mean that they needed them. And they gave them soap to go into the showers. Real soap. But there was a selection. And Josef Mengele, Yimach Shemo, with a white smock, and a stethoscope, the chutzpah, is doing the selection. Ki'ilu, he's a doctor at the head of the line, and he's sort of checking to see who's physically fit for work. And of course, you walked into the camp, right? Arbeit macht frei, work will set you free. But you didn't have to be a genius. I mean, you see all the young, strong, healthy going one way, and you see all the old, frail, the little babies going another way. You know by now, after a few years with the Nazis, you know which line you have to get on. And there's a woman with two boys, her sons. And she's 5 or 6 places ahead of Elie Wiesel. And Mengele, with what they describe as his evil sneer, looks at her. He doesn't say a word. He just looks at her and points one finger to the right, to life. And she doesn't get it. And he starts screaming at her, Du und ein! You and one! And she still doesn't get it. And smiling now, he looks at her and he says, You choose. And she goes completely mad on the spot. I mean, could you imagine? And I have Baruch Hashem 4 children. I can't imagine. How do you choose? I can't imagine. So she goes mad on the spot. Vayita mishuga, you will become mad.
V'ayita ach ashuk v'gazul, and you will become oppressed, and you will be a stolen, you'll be a piece of property. Kol hayamim, v'ein moshia, and there's no one to help you. Isha te'ares, this is Pasuk Lamed, Isha te'ares, v'isha sher yishkavena. A woman will become betrothed, but someone else will sleep with her. You'll build a home, but you won't dwell in it.
My wife's grandmother, Aleha Shalom, her name was Epstein. She's actually the niece of the Torah Tamimer, Baruch Halevi Epstein, who was murdered in the Pinsk, in the ghetto of Pinsk. And she came from the town of Epstein. That's why they took the name. They have a family tree that goes back to the Spanish Inquisition. And they left the Ben Venishti Halevi family. Torah Tamimer writes a book called the Makor Baruch, the whole source of the family of Epstein. They wandered the globe for 20, 30 years. They finally were given safe refuge in the town of Epstein, and that's why they took on the name. She was working for the Nazis, right? She was working for the Germans through 1938 because she was valued in her company. And eventually she managed to escape. She got her family out and she managed to escape, most of her family. And she never wanted to look back. She got social security payments from the German government because she worked in Germany. That's how psychotic a place that is. Anyway, the town of Epstein, sort of on the 50th anniversary or whatever it was, they organized a trip for survivors. They wanted to bring them back to show. And she really struggled with it, but she decided she wanted to go because she wanted to see her mother's grave. So they paid her way and she went to Epstein. And she went to the cemetery and she saw her mother's grave. Her mother died when she was a young girl of typhus, not related to the Holocaust. And then she wanted to go and see her town. So they went for a walk into Epstein. And she gets to her house. And she looks through the alley and she sees there's a swing set. And the swing set in the back is the swing set that she played with as a little girl that she remembers her father putting up and buying. And she sees these young blonde Aryan kids swinging on the swing set. And a woman is pushing them. And that was her family home for 100 years. And no one ever bought it from them. And no one ever paid them for it. And she took one look at this. And this wave of revulsion swept over her. And she got back into a cab and she went straight to the airport and came back to Israel. And I asked her, I said, you know, don't you want to fight them and get it away from them or whatever? And she just wouldn't talk about it, you know? Kerem tita velo techalenu. You will plant vineyards, but you will not consecrate them. Shocha tavuach leinecha. Your ox is slaughtered before you. Chamocha gazul milfanecha velo yashuv lach. Your own flocks are given to the enemy. There's no one to do anything about it. There's no justice. Your children will be given over to another nation. And your eyes will see this all the day. And there's nothing you can do. And you can read through this pasuk, right? Vayita memashesh batzorayim, kasher yemashesh ha'iver, right? And you will grope around in the noonday sun, as the blind man gropes around. And the Mefarshim asks, well, the blind man doesn't grope around differently in the day than he does at night. Except, of course, if you're blind in the daytime, right? It's very different from being blind at night, because at night you know no one else can help you, no one else can see. But in the daytime, you know everybody can see, and if they don't help you, that's even more painful. And I'll leave this for you to think about. You know? To me, this chapter speaks of the Holocaust. And if you get a chance one day to sit down with a commentary or a little English and to read it through, so, you know, what that does for you, I have no idea. And you leave reading this parak. In fact, our custom is to read this parak in a low voice. You know? That it shouldn't be, you know, we shouldn't declare it. And there's a famous story of the Kloisenberger Rebbe. Kloisenberger Rebbe was a very famous figure. He started out the war, the Holocaust, with 11 children. And he lost all of them in a little over a year in the ghetto. And he refused to sit shiva for any one of them. He said, how can I sit shiva for my child when thousands of Jewish children are being murdered? And because he was a well-known figure in the world, he had many connections, he succeeded in establishing an underground railroad of sorts, and he saved thousands of children. It was a drop in the bucket. I mean, there were 1.5 million children that were murdered by the Nazis, but he saved a few thousand. And eventually he got out, and he made his way to Brooklyn, to Bedford-Stuyvesant, took over a hospital, turned it into a Beis Medrash, an old building, and came. And Rav Riskin, who you may have heard of, Shlomo Riskin, he was a young boy, he was about 3 months before his bar mitzvah. And he convinced his parents to let him wear his bar mitzvah suit, and he walked to this Beis Medrash because he wanted to spend Shabbos with the Kreuzenberg Rebbe, who everybody had heard of. And he told me the story that that Shabbos was the Shabbos that it was in the summer they were reading this perek, Dvarim Chavchet. And the custom is that, you know, you read it low. And you like lower your voice because it's the Tocha God's curses. So the Kreuzenberg Rebbe, he bangs on the shtender. He says, Hecha, louder. So the Balkari is like a little surprised when it's louder, you know, like everybody knows you're reading in low voice. He thought, you know, maybe the Rebbe's hearing listens to it, went through the Holocaust. So he starts reading a little louder. So the Kreuzenberger Rebbe says again, Hecher, louder! And people don't know what to do, so finally he says, you don't understand. He says, we read this in a low voice that it shouldn't happen. But this already happened. Read it as loud as you can. Let HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself hear these psukim. Because now that this has happened, it's time to go home. Now if I was left with this parak, personally, I probably would have stopped learning Tanakh. This is a very difficult parak. The continuation of this parak is almost its antithesis. It's not parak chavtet, and why that is a whole other discussion, why this parak is put in here. It's really parak lamed. And if you look in parak lamed, and this will take all of 2 minutes, and then we'll open up the floor. And when all of these things will come to pass, in other words, this is talking about Perek Chavchet that we just read. The brachot at the beginning, the klala, the curses continuing. That I have given before you. Then you will come back. You will return from all of the nations wherein you have been placed. V'shav Hashem Elokecha, this is Pasuk Gimel. V'shav Hashem Elokecha et shvutcha v'richamecha, v'shav v'kibetzcha mikola mim asher v'tzcha Hashem Elokecha shama. Hashem will bring you back from amongst all the nations wherein you have been scattered. I remember one Saturday night, right? You know, in Israel they're fanatical about the news. Have you noticed this? Like every hour they listen, you know, you've heard this like, boop, 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 right? You know, right? You know what I'm talking about? This is the news. Every hour you hear Israelis, those news, right? They can't get enough of it. They just started at 10, they're going to hear at 11. Right? That's because if you're going to send your, you know, in this country, you don't know if the country is going to be here in another hour. So before you send your taxes in, you want to be sure it's still, right? So every Saturday night, like Israelis, we all turn the news on because you want to know, like, is there a war? What's going on, right? So one Saturday night, I turn on the news, and Dorit's upstairs, and I see there's like some special reporting going on, and there's a reporter, actually an army reporter, and he's talking into a mic, and there are Israeli military planes landing and taking off behind him. And he looks very serious. And there's soldiers everywhere, and there's Air Force, and he's like, oh my God, you know, there's a war, something's going on. So I call Dorit upstairs, we start to watch, and it takes me a little while to realize what's going on. This is the Shabbat of Mivtza Moshe, okay? Back in, I think it was 89 or 90, the Ethiopian Jewish community got caught in a civil war. And they were in harm's way, and they were about to get massacred. And by hook and crook and bribe, whatever else, the Israeli Air Force, together with El Al, mustering pretty much every plane they could gather, 300 aircraft participated in this operation, in 25 hours over Shabbat, with the complete support of all the religious parties in Knesset, flew 15,000 Ethiopian Jews to safety. And on the one hand, it makes you realize, you know, what might have been if we'd had a state of Israel just 10 years earlier. If they'd had somewhere to go. In other words, the Israeli Air Force prevented the Ethiopian Jewish Holocaust. And you see these Jews getting off the steps onto the tarmac. Ethiopian Jews, most poskim believed that they're the lost tribe of Dan. It's an interesting discussion there. Makarot, going back even to the Rishonim. In fact, it's interesting, there's a Zohar. What you do with this, I have no idea. But there's a Zohar that says that, and the Zohar was, you know, we rediscovered it in the Middle Ages, but, you know, Jewish tradition is that it comes from Shimon bar Yochai. It's a pretty old text. The Zohar says that one day, in Atchalta de Gula, when the Jews will begin to come home, the tribe of Dan will be the first one to be rediscovered, because in the desert, when the Jews marched, the last tribe to march was Shevet Dan, in the order of the tribes. And therefore, they had a very special mitzvah. What was their special mitzvah? Anybody know? If you're the last one in the line, what mitzvah are you going to fulfill? Hashavat Aveda. You find everybody's lost stuff. So they would pick up all the lost stuff. When they got to the next encampment, they would announce, and people would come to Shevet Dan, and they would get their stuff back. So in the merit of the fact that they would return the lost objects, they will be the first lost object that will be returned of the 10 tribes. What you do with that, I have no idea. You walk around the streets here, and you hear Jews talking in every language you can imagine. I mean, French, Russian, Ethiopian, everything. And it's mind-boggling. And you know what? If you could get like one of your great-great-great-grandparents from the shtetl and bring him back here in a time machine and just take him for a walk on Friday, and you walk to the shuk and everybody's talking Hebrew, and then maybe you pick up a newspaper, it's in Hebrew, and then you see soldiers, he gets very nervous, say, oh, that's a Jewish army, don't worry. And then maybe you take him to the kotel. You know what he would ask you? They would ask you, well, so where is he? And you would say, where is who? And they would say, well, where is the Mashiach? And you would start laughing. But he'd be right. Because if you think about where we were 100 years ago, that we're sitting here, that it's mind-boggling. We are living in amazing times. And there's a fundamental difference between reading it and living it. And I remember coming to this conclusion, just studying these prakim when I was in 12th grade, and it was probably the single greatest impetus that made me decide that I had to go to Israel for a year and decide what to do with this. I have no idea what you do with this. And for me, it raises the most difficult question. You know, you will meet people, and I'll finish with this, and then we can either open up the floor or whatever you want. When I was, I spent a year teaching in Pittsburgh, and had a whole group of students, and I had a group of ninth graders that, they came to me, a bunch of these girls one day, they had a particular Rebbe that was, we were learning in a yeshiva, and it was a Mizrahi school, but most of the Rebbeim were, you know, from the local Lakewood Kollel, and they were very, very, they were great guys. The only day of the year that I think they were challenged by me was on Yom Ha'atzmaut. I remember I announced that on Yom Ha'atzmaut we were going to do halal with a bracha in shul, because I used to run the minyan. But you know, obviously some people say with a bracha, some people say without a bracha. I imagine that you're going to discuss this when you get to Yom Ha'atzmaut. And then I saw that some of the Rebbeim, they were a little challenged by this, so I said, okay, you know what, I'm going to give a shiur on the topic of halal on Yom Ha'atzmaut, you know? And anybody wants to come with a different opinion, you know, come and we can get into discussion. None of them came, but for weeks afterwards, in the hallways, people would sort of stop me and ask me a question. Then they'd give them an answer. And I remember one day there was this Rav who was from Telz, who had learned with the Telz Rebbe. He said, I don't understand how you could celebrate Yom Ha'atzmaut, isn't it Baltosif? You know what Baltosif is? Baltosif is you're not allowed to add to the mitzvah of the Torah. So I said, well, it's not Baltosif. The Ramban says it's only Baltosif if you think it's a Doraita, if you're adding a biblical command. I don't think this is a Doraita. I just can't see how you don't celebrate a day like Yom Ha'atzmaut. So, oh. Then he'd come back the next day with another, like he was obviously going to someone to get questions and answers. And I struggle with this. I mean, on the one hand, how could this happen? How could this happen? So one day this group of ninth grade girls comes to me, they're very upset. And they said that they had been studying with a Rebbe who had told them that the reason for the Holocaust was because of the rise of the Reform movement in Germany. They want to know what I thought about this. And that's, I guess, the part of this discussion that makes me the most nervous. And it's on the one hand to imagine that we can figure this out challenges me to no end. To be able to know what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does, to decide that you know the reason for what HaKadosh Baruch Hu does, that challenges me to no end. On the other hand, to imagine that the two most significant events in the last 2,000 years of the Jewish people occurred within 3 years of each other, and to imagine that there's no connection, that would be mind-boggling to me. And I guess that's where I wanted to get you to. This is the question. This is what's worth struggling with. You know, Elie Wiesel says a Jew, he can affirm God or he can deny God, but he can't ignore God. And if there is an issue in our generation that we have to struggle with, I think it's probably this issue. So that's a little food for thought. You have to decide what you do with that. Maybe it'll take you a while to process that. And I just want to open up the floor for a couple minutes, and then we're going to go for a walk. Any questions, thoughts, comments, disagreements, or just general malaise and chill? Anything on your mind? Yes?
Really,
remind me your name?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's not really a question, like a question, whatever. But you remember you said the Mishubah, whatever?
Yeah.
I didn't see that in the text. Where is it?
Oh, okay. Sure. There's actually two places that you find it. The first is in Pasuk Chaf Chet, Yakecha Hashem B'Shigaon, which is madness. And the second is in Pasuk Lamed Dalad. Ve'ayita mishuga mimarei necha asher tireh. You will become mad from that which you see. Cool?
Can you hear the philosophy talking about, like, it reminds me of the Holocaust, because you think it's like over history, like it's happened more and more. Like,
Excellent question. Does this have to be talking about the Holocaust? I want you to be clear. First of all, there are poskim who believe that this is the destruction of Beit Sheni. And it could be the destruction of Beit Sheni. I cannot find anywhere in this set of psukim that it says it only happens once.
Right.
You know? And I want to make very clear, I'm not saying this is the Holocaust. Mm-hmm. Nor am I saying this is Beit Sheni. Because I think there's a certain arrogance for someone like me or us to be able to say, I know what this is talking about. What I'm saying is, when I read this, it speaks to me of the Holocaust. That's a very important difference. And I want you to know, no less important than the topic we're discussing, you know, when you read psukim, when you study, I think the difference between studying and learning is that it speaks to you. Does it speak to you? You know, if I learn and learn and learn, it doesn't affect me, it doesn't change who I am, my life doesn't change, then what's the point of all the learning? So that's what was powerful for me. What you do with it, you know, you may read this and think this is just okay, it's nice, it doesn't speak to you. Maybe you get excited about tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. I don't know. Everybody has their, you know, what they relate to. But since you're going where you're going, and since we're going to go take a walk where we're going to take a walk, I just thought this is a pasuk, a parak worth thinking about. And, you know, you can do if you want. It's a great thing to do for Yom HaShoah, to sit down in the morning and to take this parak on your own with a chavrusa and go through something fresh. Go through the Malbim. He has amazing stuff to say. And the Malbim actually has an English translation, so that might even make it easier. Whatever you do with it. Yeah. Okay, did we get Israel because of the Holocaust? I'll tell you an interesting thing. Right. First of all, to attach the word because to the Holocaust is a very dangerous thing. I'm not a Navi. I'm not even sure a Navi could answer this question, but I'm definitely not a Navi. Right. In other words, like, I get very nervous, you know. Any line that you say about the Holocaust, you know, part of the measure of whether you can say it is, could I say this with a Holocaust survivor sitting in the room? Right? So for me to say that I know why the Holocaust happened is every bit as absurd, difficult, challenging as to be able to sit in the hospital by the bed of, I don't know, a 5-year-old dying of cancer and say, I know why this happened. However, having said that, it did happen. And I think less than the question of why is our struggle of what we do with it. In other words, I can absolutely tell you that I think I know why the state of Israel rose in 1948. It doesn't mean that I know why Hashem caused the Holocaust, or did Hashem cause the Holocaust, or, you know, that's a whole other discussion which we can get into. But, you know, nothing, we once had a discussion about tefillah. I don't know if you remember this. And in part of the discussion about tefillah, so we pointed out that the word palel, tefillah, comes, according to Rashi at least, in one way of understanding Rashi, is that when Yaakov is on his deathbed, he sees Yosef and he says, Ra'ofanecha lo pilalti, I never paleled that I would see your face. And Rashi there says, Lo mil'ani li bilachshov, I didn't imagine that I would ever see you because I thought you were dead all these years. Right? And that's the same root as tefillah. So one way of understanding tefillah, lehit palel, is that I cause myself to imagine. I struggle with what I want in this world. Why is it so important to struggle with what you want in this world? Because what you want is a function of who you are. And nothing comes into this world unless you want it. There's one idea that's a major part of tefillah, is what do I really want? You know, look at the things in this world that don't exist, and I can guarantee you, it's because people don't want them. The Beit HaMikdash. The Beit HaMikdash is not unbuilt because we couldn't build it. We could have built it in 67. We were already up on Har HaBayit. We could have destroyed that golden dome. And I'm not recommending do that or don't do that. That's a whole other discussion. But we could have if we wanted to. And we could have built the Beit HaMikdash. By the way, halachically. The Beit HaMikdash is not built because we don't want it enough. How many people in the world really want the Beit HaMikdash? How many people in the world really know what a Beit HaMikdash is? In 1948, the Jewish people, after their experiences, were so determined to build a state. They so felt that it was time for the Jewish people to have a home. They so wanted it that their force of will simply could not be ignored. Now, if you're looking at it from a physical perspective, by the United Nations, by the English, by the French, whatever, if you're looking at it in a mystical perspective, there's a Kabbalistic idea that if you create an Turuta de la Tata, if you create a stirring down below, that forces Kaviyachol God to create a stirring in the heavens in Turuta de la Ela. And maybe that's what happened in 1948. So it is related to the Holocaust because that's where that Ratzon came from. It is nothing short of incredible that a people, you know, 3 years out of the Holocaust are willing to fight, struggle, and die to build a state instead of just crawling up and going into a hole. You know? There's a pasuk that we say, right? Az yimale schok pinu. Right? Every time we say Shir HaMalot. Do you ever think about what that means? What does it mean that our mouths will be filled with laughter? Why will gula, why will be redemption be about laughter? You know what laughter is? Laughter is the unexpected. Right? You see a guy flipping on a banana peel and he's in a suit. It's so unexpected you laugh. Right? George Bush was the president of the United States. You're probably too young to remember this. But when the first George Bush was the president of the United States, like 15 years ago, he was sitting on a dais at a dinner with, I think, the Japanese ambassador. You remember this? Right? And he ate something, he had like food flu, something, and he threw up, right? But he's sitting on a public dais. So the talk shows had a field day with this for weeks. Every time you turned on Jay Leno, it's like, and I'd like to thank President, right? And everybody across America was laughing. If you think about it, what's so funny? I mean, the leader of the free world threw up. That's not funny. It's funny because it's so unexpected. So why will Gula be so unexpected? Why will redemption be so unexpected that our mouths will fill with laughter? If you would have told a Jew in 1945, sitting in the shadows of Auschwitz and Buchenwald, that 3 years later he'd be dancing in a state of Israel in the streets of Tel Aviv, he would have told you you were out of your mind. And here we are. So that they're not connected would stretch my imagination. But that I can fully understand the connection, that would border on arrogance. And somewhere in between those two possibilities, we have to find our way. Does that make sense? Okay, I'll take one last question. If anybody else has a question, yes? And then we'll do some more later on, yeah? Okay, I think that's a very important point. In fact, it's interesting to me that I've given this discussion, I've had this discussion with other groups, and you're the first person to notice that. So, give yourself a little pat on the back. I'll tell you why I think that is, okay? Now, if they're going to have fun with you, they're going to pat you on the back all day, but okay. You know, it's like, take a look at what's going on in Israel today, okay? We're going through a very tough time. I mean, what happened in Amona, I don't know how politically aware you are, the Hitnatkut this summer, we're losing pieces of the land of Israel. The Jews are on two sides of a fence, they can't seem to get their act together. The Arabs seem to be getting stronger. The Hamas has taken over the Palestinian Authority. There are all sorts of things going on that are a little scary and not simple. And people have all sorts of opinions as to why this is happening, why that is happening. But very often they're looking at symptoms and they're missing root causes. You see, all these issues have very little to do with the Arabs and they have very little to do with the United Nations. Because that's just a symptom. You know, there's a pre-tzaddik that says that every nation has its purpose in the world. And the nation of Yishmael is no different. The nation of Yishmael actually, Kabbalistically, has two purposes. Their first purpose is to spread monotheism in the world, belief in God. That's why they're called Yishmael, that the world will hear that there's one God through them. Right? And by the way, the Muslims have been very successful. I may have difference of opinion as to sort of the relationship one develops with that God, but halachically speaking, they worship the same God we do. You can walk halachically into a mosque. I wouldn't advise it, you know, but I had this shaila many times in the army. If you're, you know, suspected terrorists or in a mosque or whatever, no halachic problem to work into a mosque. It's not a place of avodah zarah, of idolatry. They believe in one God. They have a second, and a billion people believe in Islam today. I'd like to see some of them be a little less fundamentalist, but okay. Walking into church is a much more complicated issue, especially a Catholic church. It's a big debate whether Catholicism is avodah zarah or not, what the Trinity really is. One of the most bizarre piskei halacha in all of halacha is that for the Catholic it's not avodah zarah, that's how we paskin, but for the Jew it is, and that creates all sorts of challenges. We won't go there right now, but halachically speaking, it's a big problem to walk into a church. I was unfortunate enough to discover this halacha when I was learning in Yeshiva just before my brother and I went to Paris. And I really struggled because I really wanted to go into the Notre Dame, and I made a decision not to do it. Just because halachically it's a real problem. And the reason, by the way, which kind of relates to our topic, for this halacha is very simple. You know, if you look back at sort of where we were in medieval history when the Rishonim were paskening their halacha, you know, the church was doing everything it could to destroy the Jewish people. Sometimes they were doing it by, you know, forced baptisms and pogroms and inquisitions, and sometimes they were doing it by luring Jews into, you know, sort of conversion. But they weren't exactly friends to the Jewish people. And I think that the rabbis did this for two reasons. One is they didn't really want Jews in church, associating with Catholics, especially at that time, because it was too tempting. And the two was, today, out of sensitivity for what the Catholic Church has done and how many Jews, you could make a very good case for saying that the Catholic Church was the real root cause of the Holocaust. So if there's a halacha not to walk into a Catholic church, I decided out of respect for the memory of all those who suffered at the hands of the Catholic Church, especially in Europe, I chose not to go in, and I've never regretted that decision, but that's a complicated question. But back to your issue, if you look at what's going on in Israel today, see, this has nothing to do with the Arabs. The second purpose of the nation of Ishmael, according to the Pritzadik, is that when the Jewish people forget their mission, specifically in the land of Israel, it's the purpose of the nation of Ishmael to remind us. And they are doing that very well. We're just not listening. If we would get our act together, if we would figure it out, if we would learn how to get along with each other, if we would develop a relationship with mitzvot that isn't because someone tells you you're supposed to keep Shabbos, if we would discover the beauty of what being Jewish is all about because it has such a message to give to the world and it has such a light that it could spread, then the world would be a better place. And that's hidden in between the lines. I don't think that HaKadosh Baruch Hu sets this up as a, if you do X, I'm going to punish you. That's a little too simplistic. It's more sort of to take a step back and on the one end to be able to say, I don't think we're meant to fully understand these things. On the other hand, to be able to say, but on the other hand, all of this is going on, we need to take a good look at ourselves. You know, it's like, I don't know, God forbid, I got into a car accident like 10 years ago. I can't tell you I know why Hashem decided to put me into a car accident, but I decided that it was an opportunity to really look at my life, and I almost died. So you do a little introspection, which the Gemara in Brachos suggests you do. So it doesn't mean I'm going to get it right. It doesn't mean I'm going to be able to say, this is why it happened. But the process of struggling with the question, that's a healthy process. And I think that we as a people need to be doing that, and I think when events get so serious, it's an opportunity to sort of take a step back and to say, okay, something's obviously wrong. We need to think about this. Does that make sense? Okay. So the biggest question, you know, which is sort of, well, how does that work, that if you don't do or you do that these types of things happen, that's a much more difficult question, which my advice is to struggle with when you've been to Poland.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.